Who is this?
It's Jess.
Miss Bradford, this is Sergeant Nash. Are you the only one in the house?
No, Bill and Barbara upstairs sleepwalking.
All right, now I want you to do exactly as I tell you without asking any questions, okay?
But what about
Bill and Barbara? No questions. Now, just put the phone back on the hook, walk out the front door, and leave the house.
What's wrong?
Please, Miss Bradford, just do as I tell you.
Okay, I'll go get Phil and Bob.
No, don't do that. Jess, the caller is in the house. The calls are coming from inside the house. This is Black Christmas.
Christmas. If this movie doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight.
Rated R.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Bela Lugosi's Undead. I'm AJ.
And I'm Spooky Ryan.
And today we are talking about the seminal 1975 slasher Black Christmas.
Woo!
And that's right, we said 75. We will get into that whole hullabaloo because I have reason to tell you 1974. In America, they're wrong. And we'll get into that. But we love this movie. This is a super dark Christmas holiday movie, and it is Christmas time, so, you know, let's get a little bloody.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the original slashers, I guess, outside of maybe Psycho, right? And then they talked about a little bit of my research, a 1960s movie, but this is really the one that kicked it off and sort of inspired Halloween, right? Is that correct?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here that's questionable how much inspired Halloween. There's a lot of questions about where this ranks in the timeline. It's in theory, it's releasing in Canada the same year that Texas Chainsaw is releasing in America. That case, it was 1974 for both of them. So it's coming out about, really in the aftermath of Jaws. And it's a very different kind of movie than what was capturing America in that summer.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it still instantly makes an impact on the genre, instantly kind of becomes shorthand for a lot of other films to copy off of. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Black Christmas is an all-time classic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Do you want to go over our reactions to the movie, or what do you want to?
Well, we should probably do the 90-second plot description.
Oh, that's fucking right. Okay, yeah. You want to do it?
sure, I will do the 90-second plot description if you want to go ahead.
Oh yeah, let me get it
timed.
All right, here we go. All right, timer is starting now.
All right, so in Canada, there's this little sorority house, and it's being watched outside by a little creeper. The creeper crawls up the lattice and goes into the attic, and then over the course of the night begins calling down to the sorority house and freaking out all the girls who live there. One of them ends up trying to go away. Her name is Claire. She gets murdered. Later, some of the other girls start getting murdered one after another while they're all trying to find what happened to Claire after her dad shows up and he's like, hey, this is really weird. I hate this counterculture movement. I hate it all. I want to get my daughter out of here. And so they begin looking for her. But at the same time, Jess is going through a pretty rough breakup with her boyfriend. They're fighting a lot. And it's because Jess is pregnant. She's going to get an abortion, but her boyfriend Peter is like, no, you're not going to get an abortion. I'm going to be a big angry man about it. Well, of course, eventually she is the only one left and she's being chased down to the cellar. When she gets down to the cellar, Peter comes out and he's like, hey, I thought you were like gone. Where were you? And so she kills him. And right when the cops show up and they're like, oh, thank God we saved her. Everything's okay, even though she saved herself. She goes to sleep. Everybody's leaving the house to try to let her get some rest. And the camera pans up and it turns out stranger is still up in the attic, breathing heavy, with the bodies undiscovered.
Yep, and the phone ends with the phone ringing. And the biggest thing is, he has blue eyes!
Oh! Yeah, there's
whips up in Peter.
Oh, I see, I didn't even think about that part of it.
Yeah, when I saw it, they have his eyes open, he's just staring at the screen. I think it's because it's like the third time I've watched it, right, too, so.
That's fair, yeah. I mean, Black Christmas is one of those movies that has really high rewatch value.
Yeah.
And for people who really love it, I mean, it can easily make a Christmas rotation for any of you misanthropes who do not want to necessarily celebrate the holiday, but still want to kind of dip your toe into it. Yeah. There's just enough Christmas music in it where it's fun. I know at one point when I was watching it today, Rachel heard the little children chorus come up and sing their carols, and it is so incredibly creepy that she's like, no more. Like, she didn't even see the rest of the movie. She's like, nah, already.
That was the part that got her, not the child.
She didn't even see the rest of the movie. She just saw that and was already like, that's enough.
Also, like, the kills in this, I mean, now that I have both movies in my head, the kills in this movie are amazing. And then in 2006, he just puts a bag over their head the whole time.
So let's go ahead and take it off of the original. Let's kind of get our initial thoughts down. So, yeah. Ryan, what do you like about the 1975 Black Christmas?
Well, the one thing that's amazing is in this time period in the 70s, it is about the counterculture, right? You know, they're talking about abortion. These women are empowered in all different ways. You know, there's, you know, what's her name? Barb, who's like sexually liberated and, you know, drinking heavily and all these sort of things, you know. So, I mean, it's dated in a lot of ways still, but it's interesting that they have all these characters that are trying to be strong women. And even the main character, Jess, is planning on getting an abortion because there's things that she wants out of her life. You know what I mean? And so these, you know, sort of the kickoff of the boomer generation and, like, you know, what is it? Probably second wave feminism? Is that right?
I don't happen to know which wave of feminism it is because I am not as well versed on when the lines on that are. But
sure.
Just for reference, Roe v. Wade came through in January of 1973.
Okay, so literally they're like, oh,
within 18 months. Yeah, within 18 months, this movie is being made with the assumption yes, abortion is legal in the United States at that point.
Wow. That's ballsy of the movie, of the director and the people willing to greenlight this to be like, we're going to talk about this directly and show how this is like move for women that are going to allow them to be able. And I think it's pertinent now that it's sort of happening. Like, this allows Jess to actually be a human being and not just a baby creation machine, right?
It's kind of crazy how much this film already resonates again.
Yeah.
40 years later, 50 years later, it's pretty shocking how on the nose it feels and how subversive it feels by simply having that as part of the storyline is pretty remarkable. The other thing to me about Black Christmas, beyond the fact that it's inventing a lot of ideas like the stranger calling from within the house, it's borrowing that from other movies, but it's the first like big movie to use that trope. Mm. It's obviously got the point of view of the serial killer, which would then become a pretty heavily mocked thing in films for years after the fact. Like, going all the way up to, have you ever seen Student's Body? Or
no.
Student Bodies?
No.
It's a, like, full-blown, like, horror parody film that is all about, like, the early slasher, but it comes out in, like, 1981. So before, like, even Friday the 13th has, like, completely reinvented the genre already. like it is still, like, making fun of all of the things about the slasher really early. Yeah. And one of the big things is a heavy-breathing murderer that's, like, talking to the audience. He's like, hey, I'm the murderer here. Listen to my heavy breathing. But it's, like, a huge thing in this movie. And, I mean, really, Black Christmas sets a template and then just gets ripped off and ripped off and ripped off. And where it relates to Halloween is a big question. Obviously, they're both slashers. They have a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Arguably, Bob Clark says he pitched a sequel to John Carpenter that was our killer from Black Christmas got captured and he escaped on Halloween and we'll call it Halloween. Okay. I don't know if it's – I don't know about that. But to be fair, Bob Clark also says that even if that was what I pitched, like, Carpenter's the one who came up with the whole idea and character and everything like that. But it's pretty crazy. The other thing to me that totally throws me off is that Bob Clark, the director of this movie, also directed A Christmas Story.
Oh my God.
Like the definitive 80s comedy. Loving Christmas was directed by the same man who directed Black Christmas a decade earlier.
What fucking wires crossed are in this man's head that he made both these?
We have to talk about Bob Clark for a minute, because it is like the most insane filmography I've ever seen. His top four movies on IMDb are number one, A Christmas Story. Number two, Baby Geniuses. Number three, Porky's. Number four, Black Christmas.
What is going on?
Just that like insane. Absolute chaos.
I know. Like,
and then there are other movies that he obviously had to direct Porky's to the next day. But, I mean.
Of course.
It's crazy that, you know, he's this pretty interesting director that a lot of people don't herald. But in some way, three of those four movies become pretty definitive, like, within their individual genre. Black Christmas, the slasher. Porky's is probably the ultimate raunchy sex comedy of the 80s. And A Christmas Story runs 24 hours a day on TBS on Christmas Day.
Right.
So, I mean, even just now got, like, another belated sequel.
That's crazy. Honestly, so, just really crazy that he was able to make so many American I guess Black Christmas was Canadian, though, so.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that there's also a lot of DNA in this movie that I was unaware of before, like, sitting down and doing some research. And I'm now going to have to go into, like, some crazy, like, deep dive in Canadian horror in the early 70s, because it is, like, batshit.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, so let's kind of talk about some of the people who are involved in this movie.
I want to bring up one more thing, too, before we move on.
One thing
that's, like, really interesting to me is this piece of a movie where there's these strong female characters, right, that are in this counterculture, but also they're being murdered, right?
Yep.
There's this looming violence that sort of perpetuated even in today. But part of me wonders in this time if this was like cathartic for the patriarch. You know what I mean? Where like these like strong women were like being knocked down a peg. I don't even know. I don't even know what the times were like really. But it's something that's interesting to me.
It is interesting because I feel like there's something there. It's like the idea that. It's frankly the idea that these women are in some way violating the social norms by being progressive, by being who they are.
Right.
At the same time, you know, they are just doing what they want to do, what they earn the right to do as human beings.
Yeah.
And it's such an interesting dichotomy between the two that it can be a hyper positive text for women.
Yeah.
Of these characters of who these women should grow up to be. But at the same time, because they're these women, they're getting murdered for it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of subtext about like toxic masculinity and how it's like destroying these women. There's so much to unpack with this movie.
No, I agree. It's just an interesting sort of take on it. Like, especially from because it's from the 70s too. It's fascinating. It's almost like part of the like zeitgeist of the culture. Where, you know, even the when they go to the cops station, right? They're like, oh, it's just your boyfriend playing tricks on you, right? Like completely engaging them because they are like, I don't know, like silly young women, right? Is kind of the feel that's there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the whole bit about how these women are just like subjects of a prank is pretty messed up the more you think about it.
Yeah.
like it's really wrong. And again, there's like a gaslighting element to it all, especially from the cops. I mean, let's be real. Like, there are a lot of dumb cops I've seen in movies, but Sergeant Nash might be the single dumbest cop I've ever seen.
Right.
Like, straight up, the worst cop in history of police. Obviously, he falls for the fellatio gag, which is hilarious. That's the other thing about this movie is it's like really funny.
It is.
Well, when it's funny, it's really funny. The other thing is, did you recognize the other cop? The one who is actually like, good at his job? It's John Saxon, who is Nancy's dad in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies.
Very cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, so he basically is able to get into this movie and kind of launch his own little mini horror career as a cop in a lot of horror movies. Because that's also his role in Nightmare. It's basically like, what if his character was like, man, I left this really messed up situation. I'm going to go south. Ends up in Illinois. And is like, oh, no, there's a serial murderer. We know what to do with this guy. We got to burn him alive.
RIP 2020.
Yeah, Jesus. But, you know, so, so let's go ahead and kind of talk about some of the aspects of this movie. Number one, so this cast is absolutely stacked. And I don't know how much you know about
this
cast.
No way I know anyone. Yeah, you're going to have to explain it to me.
So Olivia Hussey, who plays Jess, she was kind of like already a known commodity because she had won a Golden Globe a couple years earlier for Romeo and Juliet. She had won like the New Star Golden Globe. So relatively well-known person in the industry. Yeah. Her boyfriend, Peter, is played by Keir Dula, who's kind of best known for playing Dave in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Have you ever seen 2001?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, okay, cool. Just want to make sure. So he's the guy who talks with Hal. He's the guy the whole back half of the movie. And so they're like, oh, like these are the people we're going to cast. But in the case of Keir, he was not even like the first choice. And he only showed up to film for a week to get all of his scenes out. The first choice for the role was actually Malcolm McDowell, who we recently covered in our Halloween draft. He is the new Loomis in the Rob Zombie Halloweens.
Okay.
He's also, weirdly, Alex in Clockwork Orange. The people they considered for the role of Peter were both actors who had tight ties with Stanley Kubrick.
Oh.
Just, like, super weird.
That is fascinating.
The other people who they courted Betty Davis, multi-time Oscar winner, to play Mrs. Mack, the alcoholic woman who lives at the house.
I love her. I love her. She's like a feminist icon. I love her.
Honestly, Mrs. Mack, who is played by Marion Waldman, is absolutely incredible. Like, one of my favorite characters in any horror film ever. It's not even a question to me how great that character is. The other person who they approached was Gilda Radner. She was going to play the role that eventually went to Andrea Martin. Gilda Radner said yes, was ready to be in the movie, and had to quit because she was cast in a TV show called Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
And it was for the first season of Saturday Night Live.
Wow.
So that's she crazy. Couldn't show up to do the filming. The actress who they got in her place, Andrea Martin, had already won a Best Actress Award for a movie called Cannibal Girls. That movie was directed by Ivan Reitman, who directed Ghostbusters. It also stars Eugene Levy from Schitt's Creek. Andrea Martin herself has 2 Emmys and 2 Tonys.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow, super impressive.
Yep.
I mean, she was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, too.
Yeah, she is. She's one of, honestly, I know this is going to sound crazy, I actually think she should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actress for the first movie. Okay. Honest to God, she's great in My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Oh my gosh, it's funny.
And then Margot Kidder, who plays one of the brasher characters.
Barb.
She was in 1973's Sisters, which is an Alfred Hitchcock homage movie by Brian De Palma. It's basically like Rear Window and Psycho in one movie.
Interesting.
And she plays both of the titular sisters.
Yeah.
And then, after this movie, she becomes Lois Lane in the first Super Bowl. And she's also the lead of the Amityville Horror. Margot Kidder was like one of the most famous actresses in the world in the late 70s. And unfortunately had a really rough time with drugs, alcohol, and a lot of other things. And
So this like role wasn't too far from real life.
unfortunately, yeah. She
it's
did die.
It's a bad joke, but I'll lie.
It was a bad joke because she died a few years ago.
Oh.
So way to go, Ryan. Feminist icon Margot Kidder just made fun of by Ryan on this podcast.
Rest in peace.
No. But yeah, so I mean, like, this cast is absolutely loaded, and for them to have this much talent is crazy. Even John Saxon was originally going to be played by Edmund O'Brien, who had already won an Oscar, and unfortunately when he showed up to film the movie, it was very clear he was suffering from Alzheimer's, and they couldn't continue filming with him. But so there's a world in which this movie has Edmund O'Brien as the cop, an Oscar winner. Betty Davis, a 2-time Oscar winner as Mrs. Mack. Malcolm McDowell, multi-time Oscar nominee. And Gilda Radner, like, one of the comedy icons. Even with losing those people, it still has an absolutely stacked cast.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy how good the cast is. I don't know of very many horror films that are this deep.
Yeah, absolutely. I just am on IMDb and I just love that, like, this guy, Jod Rutter, is just laughing detective. Like, he just is the guy that laughs at the fellatio joke and he's got a credit. Like, and nothing else. I mean, he's got no picture. Like, this is all he's in. No, actually, he's got a lot of things. He's a laughing detective. He's a hiker, a volunteer.
r- r- real big career.
Sorry,
so let's get talk about some of the individual scenes in this movie, because it is great. When I see that first tracking shot and it begins in like the house and you hear the Christmas music, it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you realize you are in the killer's POV and he's been watching the house for like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. It is like one of the creepiest realizations in any horror movie.
Wow. Yeah, I wonder how they got... The one thing that's super creepy is, like, his eyes. Like, his eyes have, like, a red tint to them. Like, I'm like, how did they do that? It's like, is it just a, like, a contact lens? Did they have that back in the 70s where you could do that?
They probably did. I mean, I know some contact lenses were glass, so they could potentially...
Right, those damn glass ones.
but at the same time, yeah, there's a lot of really cool things they can do with makeup effects, and I feel like that's something they could have pulled off.
Right.
I would also say that first phone call is, like, really unsettling. I think
yes.
the way that this movie is the most effective is just how unsettling it is.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Like, what would you say is some of the more unsettling moments for you?
You know, I think obviously the end sequence where she sees them, like, both dead in the bed is obviously pretty unsettling. But I think that the top scariest movement in the entire movie is when she looks in the crack of the door and he's like there, his eye is just staring at her.
Absolutely chilling.
I mean we'll get into it later, but what I love about this movie is that it's so mysterious. Like, you don't know anything about this killer. He's just doing this and you're like, who is it? It's almost like a murder mystery in a horror movie, in like a horror slasher. You're like, who is it?
Yeah.
Is it Peter? It could be Peter. Like, you know what I mean? Could it be a cop? Could it be one of the cops? Like, could be one of the cops, you know? And also, I don't know where they're getting this, it has to be based off of something, because all of the information, like all of the stuff is so true crimey. You know what I mean? Where the killer like escalated, it started with this like little girl in the park. You know what I mean? And it slowly like escalated to this. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, where are they getting this? This is, like, really good. Like, really real to life if this was going to happen. You know what I mean?
Part of me wonders how much of the little girl sequence is actually this killer. Or if it's a different killer and they're being distracted in both directions, right?
Sure.
That it could be just rampant crime in this town.
Right.
And instead they're just not realizing it.
Yeah, I mean, that would be even scarier. I mean, I guess the whole piece of that is that, like, you know, the world is chaotic and scary is, like, what they're playing on. You know what I mean? Like, that feeling thought process.
Yeah, very much, because I think where this film is at its best is definitely the sequences where it is just got you totally enraptured in what's going on. The sound design, the camera movements, everything has got you, like, hyper-focused on this situation for these women, but at the same time, there's so many questions that's asking about who is this person? Why are they doing this? And by not giving you the answer, it forces your mind to wander and fill in the blanks yourself.
Yeah.
And this is a perfect situation of sometimes we come up with ourselves is scarier than the reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there is a background, according to everybody who's involved with the project, and they remain pretty tight-lipped on. The only thing we really know is that the killer is a guy named Billy, and he had a little sister that he references. And then you hear this, like, woman screech in some of the phone calls.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the victims. But most of the time, it's just – it seems to be coming from within him. And again, like you said, it's got some psycho inspiration there where maybe he is, like, recreating the sound of his own sister's death. But we don't have that information. And so it's like a full-blown lunatic person.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have no idea why he's doing it, which is even scarier. And also, like, having the backstory makes it feel real, right? Like, it feels like he knows what he's doing, but he's so deranged that you have no idea why he's doing what he's doing. You know what I mean? Which is even scarier. And then, what was I thinking about? There's another piece. Go on, and if I think of it, I'll bring it up again.
Well, and so, to me, the difference between this and, say, Halloween is that I think that on its face, Michael Myers is a scarier villain because when he wears the mask, he's just blank. And again, you can project what you want to onto him. But we still have a general backstory of this was a little boy who killed his sister And right. why he killed the sister may not be important. We just know he actually did it. This yeah. one is almost scarier in the fact that we don't have the details in a hard, concrete way. But at the right. same time, because he is loud and because he's when he screams into the phone and we hear him talk, we're given like almost tidbits into his psyche. But the biggest thing, again, is that we know that he is a mentally broken person. Right. And so he's maybe not as scary as the more controlled Michael Myers. And I think that yeah. that makes for an interesting compare and contrast, is that you have like the full-blown lunatic versus the controlled serial killer who is remorseless.
I mean, I think for me, the thing that makes Black Christmas scarier is that, like, Michael Myers is, like, quote-unquote predictable, right? Even yes. Loomis knows where Michael Myers is going to go. He kind of knows what he's going to do, and they have to try to stop him. Whereas this guy, like, you don't know why he's doing this. You don't know what's going on with him. Like, he just seems unhinged, which is even scarier. You know what I mean? And I remember what I was thinking about is that not knowing all the details kind of puts you in the character's minds. You know what I mean? When yeah. she's talking, when they're, oh, was Peter ever in the room with you when this was happening? And then you're kind of with them going back and thinking about it. And when she's like relieved, you're like, huh, I wonder if she should be relieved. Like, do you know what I mean? Which is all going on probably in these characters' minds. But because we don't know any of the backstory, we're like trying to piece it together with them. We're like worried with them, worried about them, which is like really, really cool.
Yeah, I think that placing us in that mindset, again, adds to what you were saying earlier about it having almost this murder mystery vibe to it.
Yeah.
Like similar movie recently, Bodies, 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 mm-hmm. where you're trying to figure out what's going on and right. who the killers are, and your ideas are constantly changing. Right. And again, this one just pulls the rug out from under you and says, haha, no, you're not going to get any of the answers.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so did you have any other thoughts before we talk about how this movie was released and why I keep referring to it as a 1975 film?
No, I think I got to touch on a lot of things I wanted to.
Great. So the big thing is, in 1974, when this movie released in Canada, it was basically a massive success, like, instantly. By the time that it actually released and finished its theatrical run, it was, like, the third highest grossing movie in the history of Canadian film at that time. Just massive hit. It had already grossed more than $2 million and was just like a big, big deal. So everyone's like, oh, great. We're just going to go ahead and roll this movie straight into America. However, the problem was when they released it in Canada, it was in October 1974. They held on to it for a full year and didn't release it till October 75 in New York and Chicago.
Mm.
So, not sure why that was the case, but the other thing they did, and this is really indicative of how dumb people are who sometimes work in these fields, they were concerned that the movie's name, Black Christmas, would make people think it was going to be a blaxploitation film, which blaxploitation films were a really big deal and made a lot of money. So, even if some people mistakenly believed it was a blaxploitation film, first of all, they would realize pretty quickly that it wasn't, because there's no black people in the movie.
There's literally no black people the entire movie.
Right. Like, that's number one. But number two, yeah. they instead refer to it as Silent Night, Evil Night, which is just like a way worse title.
Way worse title.
And so nobody went and saw it, and so they shelved it. And then they're like, well, what do we do? I know, we'll release it again, but this time, Christmas.
Of course.
And so they released it again Christmas, and again, nobody went and saw it. So it kind of, like, didn't make money in America at first.
Wow. Yeah.
Over the years, it eventually got given its name, Black Christmas, again, and became a huge success worldwide. But at the time, it basically didn't do anything. Just
That's
very
fascinating.
Very frustrating run for everybody involved.
I'll say, though, like, you know, even, like, Halloween doesn't really push on the counterculture, push the limits of what a horror movie can be as much as Black Christmas does, right?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
I wonder if there was, like, moral outrage over, like, I don't know, loose, promiscuous women. Like,
when Kidder goes on that entire diatribe about how the turtles have sex for 3 straight days. And how she wishes that could be her, but instead the men only last 3 minutes. What? Like an all-time flex of a move? Like whoever decided, I'm going to write this, and she's going to deliver it straight-faced. And she, like, never actually, like, doubts herself. She never finds the comedy in it, even when Andrea Martin is, like, breaking in the corner. And that was just, like, pure charisma and hilarity for the entire scene.
I think that's another piece that we should talk about a little bit is the fact that he does have some comedy background and that is interlaced in this movie so well.
I mean, it's true. It's one of those things that we've talked about before where when you are – one of the ways to be most effective as a horror writer, the reason why so many people come out of comedy and are able to transition over, like, you know, your Jordan Peele's and your John Krasinski's and stuff like that, the reason they can do that is because they understand timing.
Right.
Like, inherently. But beyond that, they also understand how to elicit reactions from the crowd and the audience.
Right.
And so if you know how to elicit a reaction via laughter, which is like the hardest thing to do to get people to laugh.
Sure.
If you can do that, it's much easier to scare people.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, like being able to build those tense scenes, being able to make people really second guess themselves and get freaked out, it does come secondhand to people. And so, yeah, somebody, you know, somebody like the director being able to, you know, bridge both gaps, being able to bring out the comedy and Clark having a pretty strong horror background, it's not that surprising.
Yeah.
All right. So the other big thing that I know that you want to talk about is the proximity of this film to a certain series of murders happened at my alma mater. Do you want to take the floor?
Yeah, no, absolutely. When I was watching the movie, it was literally 3 years later, if it was 1975, right? Because it's 1978, yep. Ted Bundy retreated to Florida after escaping from jail for the second time and committed the co-ed murders. And while I was watching the movie, although I don't think that, you know, one, that we should stop making movies because of this, but it did make you wonder, did Ted Bundy watch this movie at some point and then start to fantasize about doing something very similar and then literally did it, literally brutally did it. And I don't know, what did you find, AJ?
Well, so what I was reading up on is that apparently they tried to, again, this is one of the many times they tried to re-release the movie under a new name that just like was not working. They tried to release it as Stranger in the House.
Okay.
And it was going to premiere on NBC's Saturday Night at the Movies, which,
oh God.
I'm sorry, I cannot imagine airing this movie on, like, broadcast network television.
It's pretty gruesome, yeah.
Yeah, you have to cut back a lot. But yeah. Let's, ignoring that, they chose to release it in January 28th, 1978, which was exactly 2 weeks after the homicides.
Oh, no! Did they do it?
They did not do it. They ended up pulling the movie, but... Yeah, because, like, it literally had a full court press from the governor was like, don't do this.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that.
So, yeah, they
that would be
they
horrible
did not do
look.
It.
It's interesting.
But, Jesus, like, again, to your point, this is a movie that has, like, skated by in the culture in a lot of ways and also simultaneously was not that big of a hit. And it's almost like in spite of itself.
Yeah.
It did play it in some markets, but they let, like, a handful of southeastern states, namely Florida, Georgia, Alabama, skip over.
Yeah,
that.
They played a Christmas movie or something.
Yeah, they played a completely different movie. I don't know what the movie was, but, yeah. I mean, like, seriously.
It's Wonderful Life or something. Something, like, about suicide. Like,
yeah, so, pretty
that's
upsetting.
What that movie's about. Like... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's I don't know. I mean, like, Black Christmas is just like this. It's so good in so many ways. Let's see, what were some of the other things that I loved about it? The Claire death is just like an all-timer to me.
Super scary. Terrifying lady.
So scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the fact that they just leave her body in the movie over and over and over again.
Yes. And it's like just out in the open. Like, you could see her.
It's
from the road.
One of the most grotesque images I've ever seen in a horror film
Yeah.
is her strangled with the bag over her mouth with the breathed in. And have you ever seen the poster and seen what the actual tagline of the movie is?
No, it's a tagline.
The tagline is, if this picture doesn't make your skin crawl, it's on too tight.
No!
It's because you're dead. It's because you're dead.
Oh my god.
No, seriously though, it's one of the most upsetting images. They knew what they had the moment they had it.
No, absolutely.
Like, chills to the bone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that they don't make slashers like this very often because
especially.
Yeah, because it doesn't really, like, doesn't follow the tropes. Like, none of these women, quote unquote, deserve to die. Like, there was no expectation that things were going to happen. Like, you kind of like these people. You know what I mean? It feels more.
A lot. I actually like these characters a lot.
Yeah, me too. And it almost feels more like a true crime, like, scary thriller than it does, like, a horror movie. You know what I mean? Because it's like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. You know what I mean? And, you know, I really wonder if back in the 70s, if they felt the same way. Because after the Bundy killing, like, you're like, oh, wow, this actually does fucking happen. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if people back then is like, oh, yeah, that's really scary. But, like, that doesn't happen. Like,
well, that's the thing, right? Like, this is about the era where they're becoming aware.
John Wayne Gacy, like, fucking Ted Bundy. Like, a couple years, I mean, 20 years later, Jeffrey Dahmer, like... You know, it's like right as this stuff was ramping up. Like,
well, I was gonna say, have you ever seen the TV show Mindhunter?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, like, Mindhunter takes place in the middle of the 70s. I mean, so it's one of those things where they were just about to come on all of the able to understand all of these phenomena, and absolutely. You know, the Manson murders are still in the not too distant past as well.
Right. Exactly.
They're just not quite there yet. And this is just, again, a wildly subversive film, not only in its gender politics, but depictions of violence.
No, I know. It's like, it's very, very violent movie. It's interesting because it's not violent in, I don't know, when you're watching Halloween, it's like you're watching an action movie. You know what I mean?
At times.
When you're watching Black Christmas, it's like, you're like, oh my god, please don't kill this person. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, even the Mrs. Mack death, which is itself almost cool. Played for laughs and also a cool death.
Yeah.
I mean, the character up to that point is basically just the comedic relief through the whole movie.
Yeah.
You kind of see her as the person who's like, when she's drinking a lot, when she pulls out the B is for booze, and she opens the book and it has the... And then she's pulling the other one out of the toilet. Like, she's got it all over the place. But the fact that she's looking for her cat, and then she just stumbles upon the body, and she's like, oh my god. And then she turns around and sees the killer. Yeah. Like, it's so unsettling. Yeah. And the fact that, again, we care about this person is, I think, it's one of those things that horror movies could learn from a lot, is to take the care to build up who these people are before they die, because it leaves an impression on you.
Yeah. Absolutely. But it also, I mean, if you, you know, if you read the, like, what is it, Men, Women, and Chainsaw or whatever, that book, they make horror movies on purpose so that they can be appealing to the mass audience, because if you scare them too much, they won't want to see your movie. Like, and this movie is legitimately grotesque and really fucking scary. So our fans should go and watch it. But people that don't like horror movies and are scared of horror movies, this is a really, like, it, like, kind of sits with you, like, afterwards. Not any of the images, just the feelings that you get from the movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So anyways, I think that we can go into the rewards unless you have more to say, or what do you think?
The only other thing I was going to get to is we can't talk about the Chainsaw Awards from Fangoria because it didn't really exist yet. Talk about is the Saturn Awards, which the Saturn Awards usually give out prizes to the best of, I mean, today they mostly do it for, like, superhero movies, but they used to give out the best of the year to, like, fantasy and the horror. Those are the old, real genres that they like to cater to. And so they're more of, like, a populist award. What's interesting is this is the third ever Saturn Awards, and the 2 years prior was combined into a single year.
Oh, wow.
So they did 1974 and 1975 together as a single year. And they nominated 5 films for Best Horror Film. So I'm going to give you, obviously, this one. I've never heard of Bug, but it's a William Castle film. So it's probably very, like, silly and exploitative. Okay. There was also Phantom of the Paradise, directed by Brian De Palma. Okay. Then there was Vampira,
Which, I've heard of Vampira.
But Vampira is a parody, and it also is a parody because it's making... They also changed the name in the United States like they did for Black Christmas. Then they called it Old Dracula in the U.S. because of the success of the film that won Best Horror Film this year.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you a guess. Do you happen to know what won Best Horror Film this year? Think Old Dracula and think about what other, quote, horror films would have a similar name to that.
Old Dracula. Nosferatu?
No.
Too old.
Yes. Wait, too old. Young Frankenstein.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Yeah, so they kind of built more of an audience off of the success of Young Frankenstein, which won Best Horror Film. Obviously, Young Frankenstein is a comedy, and an excellent one at that, but also it's a comedy slash musical. It is not really what I would consider a horror film, but there are a lot of people who do consider it in the horror comedy genre. So it has monsters, I guess we can soft call it that. One other movie is also nominated for Best Horror Film this year that you and I both love. It is the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, so, great. I mean, it's silly and weird and, again,
it's
a horror comedy musical.
Yeah, but, we might have to cover that at one point.
Yes, Ryan, we're going to cover the Rocky Horror Picture Show, obviously. As we do it, we're just going to have people like come in and just scream stuff at us.
Yeah, exactly.
Middle of the record, they throw a ball of rice. All right, so with that, let's go ahead and get into our awards. So the number one is, let's go ahead and talk about the best kill in this movie. I think it's pretty clear-cut, but let's run through them anyway. Sure. The Claire death via bag, that has to be on the table. We also have to talk about Barb getting stabbed to death.
Yeah.
It is a pretty horrid scene.
Yeah, with the unicorn.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Mack with, would you consider it like a hook?
Yeah, why is the hook there? But yes, it is a hook.
Like, well, it would be a way to help, in theory, you would drop the hook down in the attic, and then you could, lock it onto, ropes around a crate.
Wow,
and then...
what a terrifying thing to, have in your attic.
And then Phil's death, which I believe is strangulation by telephone?
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm blanking on how Phil dies, but I know she gets killed. So,
she goes into Barb's room and then he shuts the door behind her and it's insinuated that she's killed. That's why you can't think of it.
Okay. So, with that, what is the best kill in the movie?
I think the bag has to be it. I really like Barb's death with the unicorn glass figurine is super cool, but it's how creepy and how it holds that death. All the way through, you're like, this is how ghosts are created. This woman suffocated in the attic. That is how ghosts are created.
I mean, at the end of the day, the Claire death, I think, is honestly a Hall of Fame Mount Rushmore death in any movie. So it's really hard to possibly go against that.
No, I agree.
All right, so the Gone Too Soon Award, which character do we think could have served the movie better? Honestly, I'm going to just go ahead and give that to you. It's Miss Mack. She's the character that would have added more if she had been in the movie for longer, because she would have just had more silly antics.
Yeah.
And it would have made the movie funnier. But the only other character I could have seen that I would have liked to have survived the movie would have been Barb. If she had been the final girl with Jess. Yeah. But unfortunately, that is not how it comes to pass.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. How about the best effect in the movie, the Tom Savini Award?
Maybe this one, hook. What do you think? Give me some options.
There's not really a lot of good effects in this movie. I think there's more good scenes
where
they use an effect, utilizing the sequence where, before he kills Claire, the first person point of view through the glass or through the plastic bag.
Yeah.
It's a harrowing shot.
Yeah.
I think the use of shadows.
Yeah.
Is really effective. After he commits murders, you kind of see the shadows on the walls of him moving from room to room, but we don't actually see him.
Yeah.
I think that can be pretty effective at times.
Yeah, I can.
But I don't know if there's many
filmography
effects.
Could that be an effect? Like the filmography?
Or the cinematography?
Yeah.
Yeah, the cinematography, I would say, would probably be the best effect of the movie.
Yeah, I think the best shot in the movie in that is the eye. Where she just sees the eye there. That's just so terrifying. I still see it burned in my fucking eyes.
It's again one of those iconic horror shots. So
yeah,
I'll agree with that. All right, the scared of shit moment of the week. We've got the first phone call which we kind of talked about this a little bit, how upsetting it was to listen to him talk and say some pretty nasty shit. But when Barb takes back the phone and, like, wants him a little bit, when he just goes completely silent, the flat delivery of "I'm gonna kill you" is so harrowing.
Yeah, I know. He's like, deranged, hey, like, fuck you, like, go, I don't know, whatever, jerk off or whatever. And then he's like, just no longer deranged. It's like, "I'm gonna kill you tonight."
Yeah, it's it's basically like, when he says that, it's clear that almost the deranged aspect is to get a rise out of the girls.
Right.
And he's far more in control than we would like to admit.
Exactly.
Yep. And then there's also the POV through the plastic bag, which we both said is very scary. Obviously, Claire's death is kind of tied into that. The arrival of Billy in Barb's room when he first walks in and he goes up and kills her. Very upsetting, tense sequence. The call is coming from inside the house, which obviously would be used later.
Iconic.
What a Stranger Calls is the movie that most people associate it with. The call is coming from inside the house is pretty great. When you actually see Peter yelling at Jess about how you can't have the abortion, I think that is like an extremely traumatic
sequence. No, I agree. That felt real. That fight felt real. And another piece about him in general that's interesting is like this toxic masculinity piece of like he can't, all his failures are due to his partner, right? Because she told him she wanted to get an abortion, and that's why he can't play well, and that's why he's leaving the conservatory. Like, it's just like, dude, like,
girl. I actually wrote down a bunch of his, I wrote down a bunch of his lines.
Yeah.
And like the pure like acidity coming out of his mouth, and also like the toxic masculinity of it all is astonishing. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Do you ever think about anyone but yourself?
Yeah, I know.
Do you know how important this afternoon is for me?
Like, I know.
The fact that he delivers those lines back to back.
I
mean, right there tells you everything, right? He has no self-awareness.
No.
During that fight, selfish bitch, what the hell are you trying to do to me? Let's get one thing straight. You are not going to abort that baby. If you try to get an abortion, you're going to be very sorry.
Right.
Like, I mean, Jesus Christ. Like, that is actually scarier than the actual.
No, I know, it's terrifying. And you could see, like, I don't know, a toxic man saying that to a woman. You could see that happening. You know what I mean? So.
Especially in 1975.
Right.
Especially when we are less than 2 years away from this decision even being announced.
Right, exactly.
Like, this is still a very hot button issue for people, I mean, 50 years later.
Right. And still, you know, still. Unfortunately, men still talk to people that way. Haven't really evolved too much. But
sadly, no. I almost want to give that the scariest moment of the movie because of how upsetting it is. If it was not for the actual deaths that occurred in this movie.
So fascinating that it's a man that... I wonder how much women were a part of the writing and things like that. Because it feel like he wrote these female characters so well, right?
From what I understand, there's quite a bit of collaboration on the set. And there's also a lot being said about how he was always checking in. Clark was always checking in on the women to make sure that what they were doing, they were comfortable with, and that they were, like, he tried to create, like, a family atmosphere on set.
Wow, that's awesome.
What I have heard. Yeah. So if that ends up being the case, if that's true, and he was always around and always helping, I mean, he just seems like a rather empathetic person.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's the vibe that I get.
No, I definitely, especially in especially in 74, 75, he's definitely trying to make like a strong feminist movie. You know what I mean? So I really, it's just interesting because I feel like the female characters are written so well, and not a hit on Carpenter and what's her name that helped him write it, but the characters just don't have as much depth as in this movie. You know?
Yeah, I mean, Deborah Hill does as much as Deborah she can Hill. to make those characters feel real. But it's true. I mean, he also gets – one of the things is that the script does not initially feel like college girls, and he's the one who came in and he helped bring it up to that level.
Got it.
It is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Anyways, continue.
So I think that is pretty much it. Unless we also, obviously, we can talk about the zoom in on the eyes through the door.
Right.
That's another scared of shit moment. So what sequence is like the scariest? The fact that we have this many scary moments is kind of astonishing. We don't normally have that many scary moments. No. Just more like upsetting.
Right.
I would consider every single one of these legitimately scary.
Yeah, I would say if you really like horror movies, go watch this movie because it's actually scary. Like, really sit down and watch it. Don't sit on your phone. Like, experience it with your emotions. It's really unsettling. So, I don't know. I mean, I'll let you pick because I feel like I picked the last couple. Go ahead.
I'm going to go ahead and lean into calls coming from inside the house.
Yeah.
Because that scene, when she calls up, and even though she knows that the killer's in the house,
yeah,
even though she knows she should be leaving, mm-hmm. she tries to call out for her friends, and we see that the frustration. And here's the thing, is we've known the whole movie that he's inside the house.
Yeah.
So the fact that still works at all tells you how good that scene is.
Yeah, I know. Gosh.
All right, so I guess regret award, the Steve Hadley award. Barb taunting over the phone.
Yeah.
Phil heading upstairs to check on Barb. Or Mrs. Mack looking for the cat in the attic.
Mrs. Mack. Could she just try to get her fucking cat, dude? She didn't deserve a hook in the head.
definitely true. She was a poor lady trying to help these college girls and hooked in the head. Kurt Vonn most overconfident. I think this is the Barb moment.
Yeah.
Barb is a very confident character, and there's a lot to like about that. And her performance, Kidder's performance, is absolutely stunning as Barb. At the same time, her death is so predictable from the beginning that it is a sense of overconfidence, but not understanding that the person she is messing with is actually as dangerous as he's letting on.
Yeah, I agree on that.
It's tragic. It's a tragic death because it's an avoidable death.
Yeah.
Like many of the others in other horror movies.
Right.
This is somebody who genuinely, like, could have survived if not for some things that's not breaking her way. The Norman Bates moment of the movie, when the whole movie turns, I think that there's really only three options here. It's the very first phone call, when you first hear him make the noises. It's extremely upsetting, and you are aware of how scary it is.
So early in the movie. Go ahead, though.
The death of Claire ends up bringing in other people from out of town, gets the police involved in the search.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's dead for the majority of the film, and you don't actually see, like, killer despite that, I think that's an interesting demarcation point.
Yeah.
Because other movies, I think, would just all take place in one night, and instead this one takes place over, 24 hours?
Mm-hmm.
And the last one I said is when the voice says, remove like a wart, which is a line from Peter the discussion. Fight. Yeah, from the Peter fight. And for a minute, injects the idea that maybe Peter is the killer.
Right. I am going to give an alternative, and you can let me know what you think. I think the Norman Bates of the moment of the movie is the very last scene where you find out that he's still there, and he's in the house.
Yep, that's right.
And then
the phone call is, and then
the phone is just ringing, and he's looking to, like, scare Jess and come after Jess again.
And she's alone in the house.
Yes.
Yep, I would agree. That's the best moment. It is a big twist that you think they've got him, and he's not actually.
Right, yeah.
All right, I feedback. This is going to come from A. Kurzweil, who wrote the Teenage Slasher movie book, second edition.
Cool.
He says, Clark's film was unfairly characterized as being cliche. I noted its reputation and importance within the subgenre continue to grow in the years after its release, and it remains genuinely frightening. I cannot agree more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that feedback from Arakan.
All right, so the last two things we have are the Mandy Award and who won the movie. So first the Mandy
Award. No, wait, we have to do the one we always skip, and I want it to be Peter. Fuck that guy.
Okay, oh, are you talking about the Randy Award?
Yeah.
Didn't we say we were going to rename it? There's a new character that
we wanted to make it the fucking guy from the Halloween movie. What's his name?
Oh, my God.
Okay, we can't
Corey.
Even. Corey. Corey, the Corey Award.
You know, the more that I think about it, there's a lot of similarities between Corey and the guy from Black Christmas. Like Peter from Black Christmas is equally whiny.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Can we call it the Corey Award? Can we please?
Sure.
We're going to call it the Corey Award. The Corey Award. All right, here's Peter. Peter gets it, because fuck that guy.
All right. Last one's Mandy Award. Who is... This, they're like a definitive achievement.
Yeah, go ahead. You're going to know better than me.
So, I'm going to go a little outside the box on this one.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and say that the only person I can say this is definitively their peak, is a Miss Lynn Griffin. She is the actress who plays Claire. So she is the one who gets suffocated by the
very beginning of the movie.
However, she did not do a lot as an actress. So she ended up being on some things. She actually ended up being on a show called Wind at My Back for a while.
Okay.
But for the most part, her career is not super large. You know what? I'm saying that, and I'm looking at her IMDb, and there's like way more TV than I realized. But at the same time, her death is like an iconic horror death.
Right.
And her mom was an actress, and also helped to cast her in the movie because she happened to be one of the people on the casting team for this film. So she kind of lucked into it and then has an all-time icon death.
Yeah.
As a result. So I want to say Lynn Griffin, whether or not this is actually like the best thing she ever did in her career, it's the thing that people will think of first when it comes to her.
Dude, what about the Cat in the Hat knows a lot about that TV series? Come on.
Oh, God.
Where she played the manatees in The Mermaids.
I truly did not know about that.
So we'll give it to her.
So we're going to give it to Lynn Griffin. All right, and the last one is who wins the movie? I also have a pretty strong answer for this one.
Go for it.
I'm curious who you think.
It's just too, it's too old of a movie. I don't know enough about that era, but I feel like everyone in here probably has some sort of a career, right? So
more or less, all of the women do. All of the women do for sure. I would have to say that the person who wins the movie is either Margot Kidder, or you can make a really strong argument for Bob Clark. Those are the two, the director of the movie. So it has to be one of those two.
Yeah.
I'm going to lean towards Margot Kidder.
Sure.
Because she was kind of a known quantity, but this was like another big performance for her.
Well, this really kicked off Bob, what's his name, Bob Clark's career, really. Like 74, and then he goes on with Porky's and The Christmas Story. And
so she, yes, that's a good point. So she actually won the award for Canadian Film Award for Best Actress for Black Christmas.
Wow.
And then immediately got a role in Terrence Malick's next movie, The Gravy Train.
Sure.
And then a couple of years after that gets cast as Lois Lane.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like she wins. And I feel like Bob Kidder, Bob Clark, probably goes more in that comedy route later on that kind of...
It's true. He does, kind of have to change his entire route. He kind of exhausts the horror stuff pretty quickly.
Yeah.
It takes him like 8 years to have Porky's.
Yeah.
Where she is in the biggest movie in 1978.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right. Okay, so with that, do you have anything else you want to talk about in terms of this awesome movie?
Yeah, no, I think the only thing to talk about is that I did watch 2006, and I want to talk about it just because I wasted my life doing so. So Black Christmas had another movie in 2006, and me and AJ were kind of talking about it before, and to miss the mark so deeply on what Black Christmas was and just make this like shitty, like early 2000s slasher. The women, I guess, are supposed to be empowered by like being like, we're sisters. We stick together. Like, I'm like, oh, God, dude, you like, none of these women are like hyper empowered. They seem to be just like, sort of like, I don't know, like normal girls in that time period. Like, it would have been cooler if they were part of like a counterculture. Do you know what I mean? And there was so much good counterculture in 2006, but it just seemed to be a cash grab. And then just like the Rob Zombie movies, they explain the killer and also they make him yellow, like a Simpson. I don't.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Are you sure you weren't watching Sin City, Ryan?
No. They made him yellow. He has a liver disease that makes him yellow. Anyway.
That is very odd.
Yeah. Add a second killer. It's not good. Don't watch it. I mean, it's just so bad. And yeah, I just don't understand how you watch the 74 movie, 75 movie, and then say, this is gonna get that same feeling. It kind of feels just like a cash grab. And me and AJ were kind of in high school at the time of this movie coming out. And that is kind of what horror became in the early 2000s, was like a bunch of cash grabs. And it wasn't until, you know, you got over the whole slasher, the gore porn stuff. And for me, the first movie that I was like, oh shit, this can be like horror movies about is like The Strangers. You know, it took a while for horror to like find its footing again. So I think Black Christmas 2006 is like the epitome of that, though.
So there's that. The one that I've always heard about is the 2019 one.
I haven't seen
it. That seems to be extremely divisive. Yeah, we have not seen it. So we're going to have to just go ahead and pencil that in for next Christmas.
Sure.
Because, yeah, it seems like one that it's got 40% Rotten Tomatoes and then got a D+ Cinema Score. So those aren't great. And at the same time, people who I know, like, really like this movie and really love it and think that it's a really subversive take on the franchise. So I'm going to have to say that we'll have to give it a try next Christmas and see how we feel.
Sound good? Stick around for next Christmas.
Yeah, they made a bunch of money. It came from Blumhouse. Like, there's a lot here that's interesting. We just haven't seen it.
Yeah, I mean, the girls look closer to, like, they look a little bit counterculture-y, at least in the front, so maybe they hit it a little bit more on the head.
I mean, Imogen Poots is one of the actresses, and she's literally one of the girls in Green Room, the Nazi movie.
Dope.
So.
All right, getting there.
All right, cool. All
right, guys.
So, with all of that, I'm AJ.
You're not, I'm Spooky Ryan. Keep it spooky.
Peace out, guys.